Here we're talking about it in a, we use the word interior because we have interior data. We use the word elastodynamics, I see it's misspelled, which says that we have an elastic problem. We're looking at elastic waves that propagate in the body, and of course inverse problems. We're interested in recovering shear wave speed, and the particular experiment that we've been targeting is the transient elastography experiment that Matthias Fink just talked about. We have a working group, it's funded by an NSF focus group grant, and this includes postdocs Lin Ji and Junrock Yoon, and Junrock is here today, and a mechanical engineer who's a very good modeler, Antoinette Mantiotti, and her student Yunyoung Park. And I'll talk about quite extensively today an algorithm that's been developed by Dan Renzi, who is sitting here in the front row. Okay, the data that we have when we use measure data is measured in Matthias Fink's laboratory. Okay, I always forget. Okay, so let me talk about this problem in general. This isn't quite convenient. Let me talk about this problem in general. So what we are thinking about, what people are thinking about when they talk about elastography is there is some kind of boundary excitation usually. Now, Matthias talked about an excitation which is inside the body, which of course is very exciting for us to learn about. But let me just talk first about this boundary excitation. And then people are looking at interior displacement, and they measure that interior displacement either using ultrasound or using MR. And then the idea is to reconstruct some kind of stiffness property of the body. Now there are really three experiments. One of them is static compression. So what you would do is you would just press the tissue, and then usually there's about a 10% deformation, and then you would measure the displacement after compression. Now, because there's about 10% deformation, in fact, we believe that you would need a nonlinear model. It's really quite a lot of compression. There's a second experiment, harmonic excitation, and really, I guess in the literature, that was the first one that I was reading about, and that is you do this harmonic excitation in the body, and then you have to wait for a little while, a few seconds, and then it sets up something like a standing wave, and then what you would do is you would measure that interior displacement in the body, but it would not be time dependent. So you would have interior displacement that is really only spatially dependent. Now the transient excitation, there are several reasons why this interested us. You do in the problem I'll talk about, there's a boundary excitation, and it's done for a very short time period. And furthermore, the wave that propagates into the body has very low amplitude. So the linear equations make sense in this case, so we like that a lot. Okay, so and at the bottom there I've talked about the different measurements devices. Ultrasound, we're very interested in this ultrasound measurement because ultrasound is regarded as a low-cost kind of experimental piece of equipment for the hospital, whereas MR is much more expensive. Okay, but there are other reasons, and we heard about some of those reasons yesterday, in fact, why you might consider using ultrasound over MR. So you heard a little bit about this experiment, but let me just describe it the way we think about it, which is very much the same as the way you think about it. Okay, so there's a two-bar device, and it gives a punch to the body. And what you want to do then for this two-bar device is you want to measure in a plane which is between those two bars. Each bar acts like a dipole source for the shear wave, and what happens, and I've drawn the same picture up here that Matthias was talking about, what happens if you look at the downward component, well, you get contributions from the shear wave which comes from both of the rods. So they add up in the downward direction. If you had a medium which is symmetric about that plane, then they would cancel. So you wouldn't have out of plane. You wouldn't have anything happening out of plane. Of course, in the body, that's not true. But in fact, in the phantom, where we have the data, that happens to be true. Okay, now he mentioned, we really haven't had much to do with this part of the experiment, but I just put this slide up here to mention that what you do is you do a cross-correlation technique with little windows in the ultrasound data. And from that cross-correlation technique, you determine what the displacement is. And now in this case, we're looking on this plane, and we're only looking at the axial component. You have to keep in mind, we only have one component, but of course the elastic wave has three components, so we're going to deal with this one component data. And I'm happy to talk to people about this, but in fact, I think you probably know more about it than I do. But we aren't working on this, but there is a discussion we would like to have because some of the data we're getting, we think we might be able to get directly out of here. Okay, I always forget. Okay, so what are the characteristics of this experiment or of the data that really interest us? Well, first of all, we're looking at a different physical quantity than people have been looking at before. So we believe, in fact, you can show that some features you can't see with ultrasound that you would be able to see with the shear wave speed. And so that's, of course, what interests us. Because we have interior data, we believe that we may be able to get higher resolution. We like the fact that there's low amplitude, the wave propagates through at low amplitude, because then the linear equations of elasticity hold, at least, you know, we feel pretty unequivocally. Of course, we're only going to use the isotropic equations. And we know that in some tissue, for example, in normal breast tissue, it's often not anisotropic, except where you have the tumor inclusion, then it often is anisotropic. But deeper in the medium, for sure, it would be anisotropic because you have fibrous structure. Okay, there's short acquisition time. We like that. I've written 5,000 images per second here with the equipment that Finck has. I heard 8,000. Sometimes I see 10,000. So, but it's definitely fast. What's that?
Depends on the disk.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So we like the fact that this a patient could move. So we're not so sensitive as some of the other experiments to motion of the patient. We like the fact that we're looking at shear wave speed. If you look at the compression wave speed, it changes about 5%. You already heard this, but I'm just trying to set the stage for my own talk. And the shear wave speed in normal tissue is 1 to 3 meters per second. This is sort of the square root of what he was talking about when he was talking about the modulus. And it can be up to 2 to 4 times higher in abnormal tissue. It could even be higher from what I heard today. Okay, well, the way we approach this problem is we looked at two features that we saw in the data. One is when you give the punch, it's a broadband punch, but what you're doing is you have a sinusoidal input and then you modulate that. So there is a central frequency, and if you look at the frequency content you see in the data, you see quite a bit of content at the central frequency. So we thought that might be a good way to start. And then also we were very interested in whether or not we could use the propagating front. So you saw propagating fronts in the movies that we just saw. And this is the feature that we've exploited the most successfully. Okay, so here we go. We're using the isotropic linear equations of elasticity, which I've written up slightly different than Matthias has done. There are some features that he also talked about. Lambda, the parameter lambda, is much, much bigger than mu. So the compression wave speed is about 1,500 meters per second, and the shear wave speed is much slower. And that's what makes it possible when you're trying to measure with the ultrasound, which is moving very fast, with the shear wave, to measure the shear wave displacement, which, of course, is going much slower. Okay, now the displacement has a compression wave part and a shear wave part. And so what we would like to do is to look at see if we can pull out the shear wave part and then recover the shear wave speed. Okay, well, we're mathematicians, so we can't resist showing some well-posedness results. So the first thing we did is we looked at how rich is the data set? I mean, if you just do a count, even if you have the downward component, you have one function. It's a function, even on this plane, it's a function of three variables. It's a function of the two spatial variables and a time variable. If we just look at the shear wave speed, and in fact our algorithms target that, that's just one function of two variables. So it seems that the data is very rich. We ought to be able to determine some other things as well. So Junrock will talk about this tomorrow, and since he gives such a beautiful talk, I'm not going to tell a lot more about it, but there are several results that we have, but in this result we show that you can get these two unknown functions. In this case we've used little May parameter mu and density, but there could be other coefficients as well. Okay, so this says that if you have a common solution and that's a solution to two different equations with two different coefficients, mu and rho, those things have to be the same. Okay. In the proof, and I won't say more about it, we definitely use the fact that we have a propagating front. We're taking advantage of that when we're doing that. And I'll let him speak more about it later. Now, the next one, oops, I was going to give that, but I decided not to. Okay, so if we look at the equations of elasticity, we just heard in the last talk that you might be willing to say that lambda is constant. Well, this theorem says if you know all three components, remember we only know one, but if you knew all three components, then and you had a boundary traction force, so we're giving a punch, which is like a force, is the boundary traction force. Then again, if you have a common solution to two different models and the lambda over rho's are the same, then you would have to have the mu's and the rho's the same. So this gives an idea of the richness of the data, and you would expect if you were looking for attenuation parameters or things like that, there would be some corresponding results that would allow you to get more parameters. Okay, I'm going to leave the rest of that to Jun Rock. Okay, so then we began to look at algorithms. Now, so in these algorithms, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that the downward component satisfies the wave equation. And of course, we know that it does not, but we are going to make that assumption. In fact, this second algorithm, for the people in the room who know microlocal analysis, we believe that we can establish using microlocal techniques that, in fact, that equation that we use for the arrival time front algorithm, it will still be valid. Okay, so the idea is to assume a wave equation model for this downward component, and then we looked at these two algorithms. One is looking at the single frequency information, and the other is looking at the arrival time front. So I want to concentrate most on this arrival time front algorithm, but let me just say what happens with the other one. Now again, our argument for doing this other one was that there was a lot of information content at that frequency. So what we did is we said, let's start out, when in the laboratory they initiate a plane wave, and let's start out and we'll track our solution down characteristics. And so we'll solve sort of simultaneously the equations along the characteristics, and then we have as an input, we know what the solution is. So that gives us the amplitude in, a geometric optics expansion. And we go down layer by layer, and at each layer, we assume that we make a B-spline approximation, and that gives us some smoothing, and then we continue down. Well, now, this algorithm works quite well. I'm going in the wrong direction. I always want to go up to go forward. The algorithm works quite well as long, and here we haven't given the traditional image because we were looking very carefully just how the algorithm was working. So the algorithm works quite well. The exact mu wave speed is this thing in purple, and the black one, of course, we get some overshoot, is what we get from the algorithm. And it works quite well as long as the contrast doesn't get more than by a factor of 2. Also, if we add some noise, we can add about 5% noise. We add that to the data, then we take the Fourier transform. And the algorithm is still working quite well as long as the contrast doesn't get bigger than about 2. Okay, so we found that just a little bit limiting because we know the contrast can get much larger. So simultaneously, while we were doing this, we began to look at this arrival time algorithm. Okay, so I have the... Use this. This is a funny combination of stick and computer. But okay, so we're using this.
Right here.
Oh, great! Oh, I didn't see it. Terrific. What's that? Yeah, I see it. Okay. So we're using this wave equation model now. And so what we can establish is that if we look at the arrival time, so what is the arrival time? You look at each point where you have data, and at first you can theoretically, and I'll talk about exactly what happens, but at first theoretically nothing is happening. And then you can think there's a first time. Well, there's not really a first time, it's the inf over times, but there's a first time when there's some action. Okay, and so we define our arrival time as that first time. So it's the smallest value of time for which u is not zero. Okay, then we can show if this is Lipschitz continuous, so this is a little mathematics now for the mathematicians in the crowd, then this arrival time satisfies the O'Connell equation. So we can do that using unique continuation and some approximation. I'll talk about that in the next slide. Okay, so now what we've done is we've said we've got this three-dimensional data, And we've extracted a two-dimensional surface in this data, and we're claiming, I would say the results show, that this is where the highest this is where the information about the inclusion is highest along this surface. Okay, well, this is great in lots of ways. It's an exact solution. We want to recover this quantity over here on the right. We've got this thing on the left. Okay, now I've written down, this is almost a trivial theorem down here, that we have this nice continuous dependence result. So on the right, if we have two different arrival times, and we look at the bounded variation norm of the difference of those two, this gives us an upper bound on the difference of what we would recover. So it's nice to have this nice sort of continuous dependence result, which is almost trivial here, but it tells us something. Okay, it tells us that if we have a noisy T, then the difference between these two things might be pretty big. In fact, we have a lower bound that's just like this. So if we're not careful about the noise, we can get quite a bit of ill-posedness. Now, to establish this, I couldn't resist putting in some proof. Okay, so let me do this on this side. So we're really using a unique continuation theorem of Eller, Isakoff, Nakamura, and Tartaru. And so what's happening here is the following. We look at some level set of our arrival time surface. We're assuming it's Lipschitz continuous. Now, what happens when we're looking at that arrival time surface is the solution is zero outside here at that particular time, and it's non-zero here. Okay, we pick a point x naught where the gradient exists. Since it's Lipschitz continuous, the gradient doesn't exist everywhere. And then we got the theorem out of Evans. There's a nice smooth function which has exactly the same value, exactly the same gradient, and it lies below U. We'll call that W. Now let's look at a level set of W. Now we picked our point x naught so that this t hat did not satisfy the O'Connell equation, because if it satisfied the equation, we'd be completely happy and we'd walk away. So let's assume it doesn't satisfy it there. Then that says in the neighborhood of x naught on this level set of W, it also doesn't satisfy the O'Connell equation. So this curve does not satisfy the O'Connell equation. Okay, so what happens? We have a solution which is zero outside here and non-zero there. Well, the unique continuation argument says that's not possible. Okay, so we're done. Okay, so we're back here. Whoops, going in the wrong direction. So we're back here. We have this nice equation, and we want to use it in an optimal way. Okay, so the first thing we have to do is look at the data and find this arrival time surface. That's the first thing we have to do. I'm always going in the wrong direction. Okay, so let's look at some time traces. So these are some of the time traces. We got some data from Fink's laboratory, and we looked at the time traces. Okay, so here's some time traces, and in fact, we've now cut the data off. So initially, what happens in the data is the very first thing that happens is you have a compression wave, and you see it everywhere. From the point of view of this near field, taking data in the near field, it's like it has infinite speed. Okay, so you see that everywhere, and then it begins to die out. Okay, and then what you look at is a time trace, and this is the propagating shear wave. So here's one point. The shear wave is over here, then point further back, it's here, the black one, point further back, it's here, it's the red one. Okay, so now you could say, all right, looks like it's sort of leveled off here. So let's look at the first place where it's non-zero. Well, there's a lot of noise in the data. Also, we're treating the compression wave as if it's noise. So we're treating the compression wave as if it's noise, so it's not going to be level. Okay, so it's not going to be level, so that doesn't look like a really good idea. Okay, and then if you look at the data, you see that there are some nice features in the data. These peaks are nice features in the data. And then you think about what the input is, and the input is this sinusoidal wave. It's modulated. And so we began to think that each piece of that wave is like an impulse that's being pushed into the domain. So we thought we have lots of arrival times then. We have the arrival time for each one of those pieces. Furthermore, if we look at a peak, it's really the zero of ut, so it's the arrival time of some pulse for ut. And ut also satisfies the same equation, so its arrival time surface also satisfies that same O'Connell equation. So that's the first thing we did. And you can see here we also have some problems with peaks, because sometimes in the data it looks like this. So we applied a mollifier to you, and then we approximate the, everything is said here. I don't have to read this for you. Okay, and we find the zeros of ut. Okay, then we began to, so we did that, and I'll show you the results of that algorithm that, that uses that data. Then in addition, we began to think, well, okay, we're really tracking features. Features in the data are propagating forward. So every feature is propagating and has arrival time associated with it. So why don't we just take this, a trace at some particular point, and then look at a correlation between other points. So we did that here. So here's the x-naught point. This is our preferred point, has arrival time. Okay. Then we take at another point, and we look at the time dependence there, and we take this t-hat of x-naught, and we ask, what, how much do we have, how much time lag do we have to introduce that we get a nice correlation? Okay. Then that time lag is what we add to t hat of x naught to get t hat of x1. So we also use this correlation idea. So that tells us we're trying to correlate all the features here, which makes a lot of sense to us. Okay. Okay, so we're still looking at arrival time. We're not solving the inverse problem yet. And here we're looking at simulated data. And with simulated data, we get an arrival time surface that looks like this. Now, what we've done is we've introduced some feature into, so we don't have constant shear modulus. We've introduced some feature. And you could see just by looking at the arrival time surface that probably the feature is probably someplace in here. If we add noise at the resolution, you know, at the size of this plot, you can't really see much difference in the arrival time surface. So this is 7% noise. So you'll see what the difference is when we look at real data, and it's clear there's more than 7% noise. Okay. So now in the previous one, that looks like kind of a nice plot. And the reason is we're given the data on a grid, and then in this case we interpolate between, and so that gives us a nice smooth surface. Okay. Oops, always going the wrong direction. Okay, so here when we're doing correlation, just to show the difference, we don't do any interpolation between. And then we, with interpolation, we get an arrival time surface like this. We still see we can see that there must be some feature going on here. So what could the feature be? It looks like the time is advancing rather rapidly. Okay, and here again, we also see some feature. If we add this simulated data now, if we had 7% noise. Okay, now we're looking at the laboratory data, and this first slide is if we look at the data defined by one of the peaks. We pick one of the peaks, we pick the third one, actually. Okay, so now we can look at if we go down the center line in this plane, we can see where what the arrival time looks like. This is just a trace going down the middle here. Okay, so that, I mean, there's no such plot that we can make in the case of correlation. And here's the arrival time surface using peak location. And here's the arrival time. And then we use interpolation here. You can see the noise in the data. And here we don't use interpolation. So now we see sort of stair-stepping effect when we don't. But down here now, this is with the correlation method. So we're identifying the arrival time surface, and here's with the peak location. Okay, so the algorithms we're looking at use level sets of the arrival time surface. So if we plot out level sets, so these are constant time, we see something that looks like this. Okay, so on the left, it's using peak location. Again, this is with laboratory data because it's not so interesting with simulated data. And here's over here on the right, it's with correlation data. Now, what happens is that we get some small closed curves when we do that, and they really muck up the algorithm. So the first thing we do is we go in and clean that up. What Dan is doing is he's looking at connected sets and just removing the ones that have short length. He's looking at the length of them. That also has to happen over here. Okay, now, the first thing you might think to do is, well, we have this data, arrival time, why don't we just, sort of the direct method, let's take the gradient. Let's just take the gradient of that. Okay, so we tried that. Okay, so here, where the wave speed goes from, I think, 1 to 4, 2 here. Okay, and this has sharp edges. And in our simulated data, I should say, in all the other slides when I was showing you arrival time, we're not assuming that we have a sharp edge. Okay, and the reason we were doing that is we decided not to go for edge detection. With the idea that if you have abnormal tissue, there's often a proliferation around that abnormal tissue, that just fewer cells that are abnormal. So we might see some gradual change. Okay, but what happens when we take this sort of direct method? Well, we get an image that looks like this. And we've cut it off so you can see the features from 1 to 3.5, but it actually goes way up to 20. Okay, so I don't know about you, but we weren't too happy with that. Okay, so we were looking for something else. Okay, so we're going to use the following idea. This is the first idea. Okay, so what we do is we take a level set, we pick a point on that level set, and we say, well, we want to recover the speed. We want to look at the next level set. So the next level set is at t hat of x plus delta t. And now what's the speed? Well, we're going to look at the distance from this point to this curve and divide it by delta t. That's the first order method. Or we can look at the distance from that point to the curve in front, and then the distance from that point to the curve behind, and we get a second order method. So we're going to approximate our wave speed that way using our Iconal equation. Okay. Well, I don't know whether we're using the Iconal equation, but we're using the idea of wave speed. Okay, so, going the wrong direction again. So how does it do? Okay, so here's our target wave speed. So we're doing simulated data. Here's what happens if we use peak location, and this is all with the first order method, no noise here. Okay, and here's what happens if we use the correlation method. And now I should explain this just a little bit, because the color coding isn't uniform. So here, in this case, we get some overshoot. So in our simulated data now, because we were particularly interested in recovering when we had large contrast, in the simulated data, our wave speed goes from 1 to 4. Okay, so but here we get overshoot with the peak method, and so we're a little over 4 here. So the color coding, that's the maximum. And down here with correlation method, we don't get overshooting. But what happens then if we use the color coding, dark red for the maximum, we see this feature here in the front, which we also have here, but we just don't see it as well. Okay, if we add 7% noise, we get more overshoot over here. And we begin to get overshoot with a correlation method as well, but not as much. Okay, so this is what we get with simulated first order method. Now let's go to second order method. Okay, if we look at the second order method, it recovers a little bit better. Of course, you saw when I went from the first order method to the second order method that this thing for the first order method was pushed forward just a little bit, and now it's pulled back. Okay, so we don't get quite as much overshoot when we do that in either case. And this one is a little more, about the same undershoot here. And we don't get quite as much overshoot here when we have 7% noise. And we get overshoot here, but not as with the correlation method, but not as much as we get with the peak location method. Okay, so that's what happens with the second order method. Still, we're using simulated data. And this is at 250 hertz. The laboratory data is at 50 hertz, but we got started using 250 hertz, and we wanted to compare it all the same for the simulated data, which is why we're doing that this time. Okay. Okay. So here for peak location, I'm going to show you the second order method. On the next slide, I'll compare. So here's the arrival time surface with peak location. Here's, at the center line, what the arrival time looks like going down here. Here's what we're trying to recover. Again, we're using laboratory data. And here's what the recovered wave speed is with the second order method. You can see we're getting a little drift here. We're not sure exactly why we're getting that drift. Okay, so again here, first order method, peak location. Correlation method, technique for finding the arrival time surface, first order method. And now for the second order methods, we have this drift if we're looking at peak location, but we're a little more on target here with the correlation method. And as we understand it, even the location of where this is may be off by 1 or 2 millimeters. When you do the experiment, that the inclusion can be sort of pushed. So we weren't too unhappy with that. Okay, so I should truth in advertising here. At the end of this algorithm, we do do some total variation denoising. So here, I think just about everybody in the room knows about this, but I will mention. So the final, F is final, that's the thing that's the thing we're targeting. Of course, we want to match the data. So D is data, so that's the data we get out of the out of that distance algorithm. We want to match it. Here's what we would get. Okay, but we want to eliminate all the variation, all this up and down stuff, and so that's what this part of it does. So this is the bounded variation norm, and if we try to minimize that, that minimizes all this oscillation up and down. Of course, the way to do this is to get the Euler-Lagrange equation, and then you introduce this evolution variable, and you solve this equation starting out with the data until you reach steady state. Okay, and we haven't really experimented very much with gamma. I believe gamma is about 1/4 here. Okay, now we can speed this up considerably, okay, if you're worried about that kind of stuff. So everything I described so far is O of n to the 3/2. We can use a level set idea and make this O of n log n. And we, and so let me talk about that just a little bit. Actually, I have no idea what time I started or...
You've been going for half an hour, so you have another 15 minutes.
Oh, well, great. Okay, good. Okay, so what we want to do is use a level set method because that will speed up the algorithm. So what happens when you look at a level set algorithm? How do you do this? So you have this surface. So what's the underlying idea? So I'm going to think of this surface as the zero level set of some larger function. Okay? So it's the zero level set going through here, and now so time is on my vertical axis and space is down here in the plane. And what I'm going to do is fix each time. So at each time, I've got some curve going through there. And so what we want to do is continue our function across on that plane. And at every plane, at every time, we want to continue the function across. And how do we continue the function? We can continue it any way we choose. Okay, but we choose in each plane to say it's at every point, our function is going to be phi, is going to be the distance to our curve. So that's the common way to do that. So it's called the sine distance function. So we're going to do exactly that. And the way you determine the distance is you actually solve an Iconal equation to do this, another Iconal equation with constant coefficients. Okay, so you build this function. You have this curve. You build the function out using this sine distance function. And every time you do that, at each time. So now you have a big function in space and time. Before you just had this two-dimensional object. Now you have a three-dimensional object. Okay, so this three-dimensional object satisfies an equation that looks like this. Okay? This F extension, so this thing we have in front here, is really what we get by extending across. But when we're right on the surface, we know exactly what it is. It's this thing we want to recover. Okay? Furthermore, this sine distance function is such that this gradient is 1. So this is beautiful. So if this gradient is 1, then we can determine what this is simply by taking the time derivative. And so we do that. Okay, so we're looking at a first order method, we take the forward time derivative, or a second order method, we do the standard thing, we take a forward and centered difference. So that's the method. It's very well known how to solve the Iconal equation with constant coefficients, so we can just borrow from these level set people. And this is really a beautiful idea. Okay, well, there are many things that are nice about it. For one thing, you can extend. When you're doing the extension, you can do all these extensions simultaneously, and that's really what speeds up the algorithm. Okay, so how does it do? Okay, here's our target wave speed. This is with synthetic data. Here's the target wave speed. We're just using first order method. Okay, here's what happens with a level set method. And now, okay, we're using peak locations here that for determine the arrival time. And remember, for peak locations, we interpolated the arrival time surface between. So using that interpolation, we can use a slightly finer grid, okay, which is what's done here. So in some sense, it's not fair because I'm comparing a little bit apples and oranges because I've got the coarser grid down here. But even with the first order method, this is looking, I think, pretty good. Okay, so here's this level set method. It's O of n log n, and here is is this method. So truth in advertising, let me go back to the arrival time surface. When we go back to defining the arrival time surface, maybe I can get back there. Yeah, when we get back here, I described that we have to get rid of these little things here. We're not doing that at n log n right now, but we are doing the level set algorithm that way. Okay, conclusions. Okay, so we have data from Fink's laboratory, which gives us time and space-dependent interior displacement. Our goal is to create the shear wave speed. We show these theoretical results, which tell how rich the data is. We see that we can get a uniqueness theorem for two coefficients. It seems that one should be able to get more. Our input in the experiment that we've been modeling is a boundary traction force. Okay, we can also, using the arrival time surface, so if we just pick out that one surface in the data, then we can still determine the wave speed uniquely. This is not, you know, rocket science. We have an exact equation that we establish. So it can still be determined uniquely just with that subset of data. We developed two algorithms. One uses central frequency content, and the second algorithm uses the arrival time surfaces data. Okay, and this algorithm has been implemented with laboratory data. And let me just talk one or two more sentences about this. One of the things we like about this arrival time surface is algorithm is that it's local. So it's both local, we have the arrival time surface, so we can really talk about recovering the wave speed just locally from the local data. Keep in mind that there is a compression wave. We're treating that compression wave as if it's noise in the data. And that feature may change from one to another. We try to use all that together. We may see some features we didn't expect or didn't want. I should say we are assuming now for that theorem that I put up there, that quick proof, that where we show that we have the Iaconal equation when we have the wave equation, using micro-local techniques, we expect to still be able to show that that's true for the shear wave front. If we have anisotropic media, I should comment about that, we expect to be able to determine what's happening, what changes we have in the coefficients in the direction normal to the arrival time surface. So from the point of view of looking at the arrival time surface, there are several takeaways. One is we only need one component. We don't need other components if we're going to lose. We might be able to get more about anisotropy, but we don't need more than one component. Second, although we use a wave equation model, the equations of elasticity, we should get the same equation. So we should still be able to do it. And we're looking forward to getting more data. We saw some great data today. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, questions?
Yeah.
Is that correct that you compute travel times for the Iaconal equation using level set methods?
We had the arrival time surface given to us, and we're solving the inverse problem. So what we want to find is the shear wave speed. When we are doing the extension, when we do the extension of our surface, let's see, let me go back. We solve, right here. In order to determine F extension, we solve the Iaconal equation with F extension equal to 1, actually, as we're going up.
More about direct problem, forward problem. Maybe you know from experience, you can use a level set method for computing travel times, or you can trace each geodesics and compute travel times.
Yeah.
So if you compare those two methods in terms of speed and accuracy, do you have any comparison?
You should ask your question to the level set experts.
It's just easier. It takes care. People do them both ways. It's just the code is a lot easier, right? You don't have to worry about, you know, curves crossing and cutting and getting rid of curves and adding curves. And I believe that they both are probably about, people use both, but usually the level set equation is easier, right?
In terms of accuracy.
And in terms of accuracy, they both are... if they're smooth, then you get whatever accuracy you want, and you have to break down the first order methods whenever the characteristic drops. I believe it's the same.
The solution is only Lipschitz continuous.
But when people say level set methods, usually they mean the level set equation, which is phi. And right. For the Connell equation, they use fast marching or something like that. It's not really a level set method.
Yeah?
It looked like most of your cross-correlation based images had this sort of second peak in it. Can you just say another word or two about maybe how I might understand that a little better? Where's that really coming from?
Here?
In the reconstruction of some kind of thing, just
Oh, yeah, this thing.
Yeah.
We don't understand that yet.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Can you reconstruct better this side of the target or the other side?
Well, it's clear what's happening here. We get some flattening on this side, right? You can see that we get some flattening. We think that has something to do with backscattering in the data. So when we get here, the wave comes and then we get some backscattering and it's altering the displacement in this region. So we believe that's true and we're looking at ways to make a correction in that case. But I don't know, let's see, let's look. It looks pretty good. Here, if we use peak location, we get this drift, right? If we use correlation, we're not getting that. So Mattias gave us data at four frequencies, and we see roughly the same thing at all the frequencies. So, but we have only this one phantom. Okay, so what I should tell you a little bit more about what the phantom looks like. Okay, I mentioned that in the phantom, we have, when you measure on this measurement plane, we have symmetry. So it's this phantom and it has a cylinder. So the new value of mu, so what is it? It's 3% agar and then there's 2% gelatin outside and 4% gelatin inside and it's on a cylinder going through here. So in the measurement plane, we do have this symmetry. Okay, that help? I mean, you're asking me to say whether or not this is better on this side or better on that side. I don't know. That looks pretty good. Not sure I would say.
Okay, no questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So let's resume here at 10 minutes past 11.